Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange, Homegrown Hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting. On the web at asmallorange.com. From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech, technology worth talking about. We're here to make technology simple, easy, and approachable for you.
Got a question about your computer, smartphone, tablet, or the internet? Give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com. Ray, I've got a riddle for you. What's black and white and red all over?
Oh, I know this one. Newspapers.
No, Ray. This is 2012. Nobody reads newspapers anymore.
Okay. A zebra with a sunburn.
No.
Okay, Tom, so what is the answer?
E-readers and tablets.
Was that a laugh track?
No, people thought my joke was really funny. I mean, tablets and e-readers, am I right?
Oh my goodness. Okay, you know what? I can do that. Hey, Tom, why did the cowboy adopt a wiener dog?
I don't know, Ray. Why?
He wanted to get a long little doggy. Come on!
Sorry, Ray. That joke was less iPad and more iBad.
What the heck?
Seriously, though, Ray, people are moving more and more to using e-readers like the Nook or the Kindle, or tablets like the iPad to read books, news, magazines, and all that other stuff. And, you know, recently I've had actually a lot of conversations with friends and even with my family members about what's the best device for reading.
Right, sure.
So what do you think, Ray? Your mom is tired of lugging a bunch of books around on long trips, and she asks you if she should get a Kindle or an iPad. What would you tell her?
Well, my mom didn't actually ask me that. But
okay, but hypothetically.
Okay.
This is a hypothetical mom.
The hypothetical mom. If my hypothetical mom asked me that, well, first off, maybe we should explain to our listeners what the difference is between the two.
All right. Well, tell us about tablets.
Okay. Well, tablets, of course, they have backlit screens. Tablets, of course, we're talking about like iPads or Android devices or like the Nook or the Kindle Fire.
The Kindle Fire.
Right. Not just the regular Kindle, but the Kindle Fire. So they have backlit screens, so you can use them in the dark without having any additional lighting.
Mm-hmm.
They usually have really great, clear, crisp screens, for really good for graphics.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like the iPad and Android devices, you can use a lot of apps or other programs on them. So in addition to just for reading, you can also do other things on them, such as web surfing. You can surf the web with them, and they're really good for that. Also, tablets have color screens, whereas e-readers only have black and white.
That's right. E-readers use a technology called e-ink, which is actual ink, which is somehow electrically moved around the screen.
Right.
Right now, I'm sure they're working on color somewhere out there, but right now the e-readers are strictly black and white. They are pretty much devices that are dedicated for reading. They are really easy on the eyes. Because of the fact that they use the e-ink and they're not backlit, you actually, you know, it's like looking at a page of a book.
Right.
They do have a limited app selection. Some of them have some apps, but they're pretty limited. They're not great for web surfing. And as I just mentioned, generally you need an external light source. Now, there is an exception to that now. The new Paperwhite Kindle and for the Nook, the Simple Touch with Glow Light, those devices both have built-in side lighting, not backlighting, but it lights up the page in a more naturalistic way. So, and typically, you know, Kindle books are available on any device. You don't actually even have to have a Kindle to read Kindle books. Now, Ray, this is obviously kind of a discussion where the answer, what kind of device do you want to read on, is dependent on a number of different factors, depending on your personal situation.
Sure.
Right. But in a nutshell, you should definitely get an e-reader.
Are you kidding? You just pointed out that e-readers need an external light source, or most of them do. They have virtually no apps, except for some really lame games. And they're terrible for surfing the web. So, I mean, how could you say that?
Okay, fair enough. But I've got to say, I got a Kindle Touch for my birthday, and I'm a convert. I'm a believer. It's been great. And I'm someone who loves books, like physical books. But after the first few days, man, it's just wonderful. It really is easy on the eyes. It's lighter than a paperback book, and I still like books, but I don't know if I would. I would definitely say I prefer that over using my computer screen or a tablet.
All right, well, screen. I'll concede that e-readers are better for fiction books,
sure.
For reading novels or stories like that. But for nonfiction books, like just not to give them props, but the Four Dummies series, mm-hmm. or any nonfiction book that includes graphs or charts or images, the tablet devices are way better, especially like the iPad or Android.
Yeah, okay.
They're going to be
color
way better.
And higher res.
Yeah,
screens.
And with iBooks, if you're buying a book on iBooks specifically, there's a lot of interactive features that you can't do on Kindle. And also, well, you kind of mentioned it with Kindle, you can have Kindle books on any device. So, mm-hmm. Just because you have an iPad doesn't mean you have to buy iBooks. You can buy Kindle books.
You could
have
Kindle books
on
your iPad.
So definitely for nonfiction books, I do think that tablets are better for that.
And they have magazines now, don't they?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And you can get them, they download automatically, so you have them right there when you open up the device.
Okay.
So now, the one thing I'll say, that you talked about e-readers have e-ink.
Yeah.
And of course, regular tablets use basically pixels, lights, to mm-hmm. show the images on the screen. So that's true too. It is a lot easier to read on an e-reader.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I used to have a Kindle,
yeah.
The Kindle keyboard, they call it now. And I found myself, I would read a book on the Kindle faster,
mm-hmm.
and I was more likely to read it if on the Kindle. Unfortunately, my daughter stepped on our Kindle and it was broken.
Hey,
so,
as a side note, you got to get a case for those things. My dad also got a Kindle and broke it right away. You need a case.
Yeah. They do have a really good customer return policy, though. So, if that happens to you, make sure to contact them. But, anyways, after the Kindle was broken, I found myself reading less. So,
interesting.
There is that.
Yeah.
There's some, they are really, though, a one purpose device,
yes.
e-readers, and that's the downfall that they have.
I agree.
Yeah, you're going to pay more for a tablet, but you can do a lot of other things mm-hmm. with it, whereas you're pretty limited with an e-reader.
I mean, you can technically surf the web on the Kindle Touch that I have,
it's
but
excruciating.
It's a painful experience.
It is excruciating. Now, I mean, though, a good thing for the e-reader is that it does come with, or some of them come with 3G. Connectivity built in.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Whereas, well, tablets do too. That's true. So,
but it's also a price consideration. With e-readers, you're looking between probably the $60 to $200 range, whereas tablets, you're starting at $200 and going all the way up to,
that's true.
Gosh, $600, $700, $800.
Yeah, there's quite a barrier entry for tablets, even the cheapest ones. Well, the cheaper they get in tablets, the less quality they
obviously.
Are generally.
Yeah.
Or they're just a lot smaller. So that's true.
So,
now, one thing I'll say is that, when you're looking at the two, you have to really decide what it is that you want out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I will go with my, we're out of the primary election, so we'll go to the the general election, and I'll become a general election politician and say, there's good sides to both of them.
Yeah.
And it really does come down to what you need out of it.
Absolutely.
If you're going to be reading all the time, especially nonfiction, or mm-hmm. Especially fiction, or especially stuff that doesn't have a lot of graphics in it,
right,
then an e-reader might actually do you the best,
mm-hmm.
especially with the new Simple Touch and the Paperwhite.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really, from what I've seen, they're a lot easier to read on.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference, I was saying, is with a tablet, the light is shining at your eyes.
Right.
Whereas with those devices, the light is shining at the book.
Right,
or
it's
at
reflecting
the ink,
off the surface.
Just like a regular book does.
Exactly.
So it is a lot better. But if you need it for more features or more mm-hmm. more apps, then you would want to go with a tablet.
And I would say either way, the first time you take one of those on a plane and you've got 10 books on there and you don't have to pack like two or three hardcovers in your luggage, you're going to be a convert to mobile reading devices.
Either way, electronic reading. So
yeah.
Well, that was a great answer. It's kind of a non-answer.
It's
like,
kind of
yes,
a non-answer.
Maybe.
Yeah. But, those are the factors to consider.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, well, we got an email from Jesso. You want me to grab that one?
Sure.
Okay, Jesso writes, I have a desktop and a laptop networked together using my wireless router and the Windows networking stuff, setting it up so that they could see each other and share a few folders, and so my laptop could see the external hard drive hooked up to the desktop, was basically the result of me pushing buttons until it worked. I really don't know anything about networks.
Just like, so I admire your gumption.
I like the way it works, except it's inconvenient to have the desktop turned on to get my laptop, to let my laptop get at the stuff on my external hard drive. Is there a way to hook up my external hard drive to something so that it can be on the network without the desktop and just magically work? Thanks, guys.
Thank you for your email, Jesso. So what you're wanting to do is turn an external hard drive into what's called a network hard drive. There's a couple ways to do this. One, as you already know, is to set up on your desktop the connection to the drive as a shared folder. As you mentioned, the problem is that you have to keep that computer that the drive is connected to on at all times if you want to access those files from another machine.
Right, and there was something that came out a few years ago that was supposed to solve this problem called the Pogo Plug.
Oh, that's a cute name.
Yeah, and it was a cute little device. It ran for about $50, and the way it worked was that you plugged it into the wall and plugged it into your router and then plugged your external hard drive into it, and voila, you had a network hard drive. And you could even access your files online and on the iPad and the iPhone. The problem was it didn't work quite as easily as expected when it first came out, and there were some hardware problems with it too. The company that still sells the device, but they mostly focus on internet-based cloud storage now.
Yeah.
And it's probably a good thing that the company did change focus, because there's another way to do this that makes the Pogo Plug look pretty irrelevant, and that is directly through your network router. A lot of newer Wi-Fi routers, including D-Link, Netgear, Linksys, and Apple's routers, have USB ports on them, so you can plug an external hard drive into it, and it becomes a shared hard drive on your network.
Okay.
Or you can plug a printer into the router, and it becomes a shared printer on your network. And many of those routers, if they only have one USB port, you can plug a USB hub into it, and then plug in multiple hard drives and multiple printers if you need to.
Yeah.
So my suggestion would be to check your Wi-Fi router and see if it has a USB port. If it does, check the manual or look on the manufacturer's website to see how to set up an external hard drive as a shared hard drive on your router. If it doesn't, maybe it's time to consider getting a new router. Just make sure that it says in the box that it has one or more USB ports and you can plug an external hard drive into it. Well, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more of your questions. This is Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Ray Hollister, joined, of course, by my co-host, Tom Brown. And we've got a voicemail.
Yeah, it's Bill. I'm in Jacksonville, Florida. I have a very simple question. I would like to get a smartphone, but one that's not the size of a small book. So, and one that has a decent battery. I've got an iPad, so I don't watch movies or do email on the smartphone. What I need is something where I can do voice-activated dialing, something that I can import my contact list into, and something, again, that I can put in my pocket.
Uh-huh.
So if you could give me any advice. Every time I go on the internet to research it, it keeps directing me to sites to try to sell me phones, and I find it very difficult to get objective information.
You know, that is one of those. There are some topics that are really hard to Google because they are so like spammed. You know
they're
what I'm
just
about?
They're just covered with advertising. You can't really find any good information about it.
Absolutely. Well, that's a hard question, Bill. Geeks like us are always looking for the best and the biggest thing on the market.
Absolutely.
So we don't often pay too much attention to the smaller stuff that comes out.
Yeah. Now, back in the early 2000s, of course, cell phones were just getting smaller and smaller. And the smaller the phone was, the cooler it was.
Yeah.
But it seems like ever since, you know, the iPhone came out in 2007, cell phones have been getting bigger and bigger as the screens have grown. Especially Android, it's kind of differentiated themselves from Apple by making bigger screens. But, and even coming to the point where there's a device called a phablet,
it's
a phone-tablet hybrid
it's
thing.
It's getting a little bit to the point of absurdity, I'll admit that.
Now, Apple was holding out with their 3.5-inch screen, but they even eventually caved in and made the iPhone 5, which has the 4-inch screen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a fantastic small phone on the market just a little while ago called the HP Veer, and before that was the Palm Pixie and the Palm Centro. And it was the size of a credit card. And it had a sliding keyboard, and it run WebOS, and it was really fantastic. For a small phone, you know, I've got big hands, but for people who have smaller hands or just wanted a pocketable smartphone, it was really great. Unfortunately, it died when HP stopped selling mobile devices back in August of 2011, when they killed the whole WebOS hardware division.
And your heart.
And my heart, yes. I am a WebOS fanboy, I'll admit. But the thing is, small smartphones just don't sell. A lot of folks find that when you use a smartphone for an extended period of time or you use it a lot, it just starts to get really irritating when you have a smaller screen. I mean, I loved my Palm Pre, but it only had like a 3.2-inch screen, and even that was getting irritating. And also, smaller smartphones tend to have a slower processor.
That's true. And you know what I think another driving factor is behind the increase in phone size is the batteries.
Oh.
You know, you want your phone to make it through an entire day of usage. People expect that now. Well, if you make a big phone, you can put a big battery in it to power that beautiful high-res screen the quad-core processor all day. Whereas if the phone's form factor is really small, you're going to have to use a smaller battery, and customers are going to feel like their phones run out of juice too fast, which Bill mentioned in his voicemail, I think, that he wants something that's going to last him.
That's true.
Of course, if you're just using your phone for texting and calling, and you're not using that much juice anyways, maybe it doesn't matter, and maybe someday someone will remember there's a market for small phones, but today is not that day.
Yeah, unfortunately. And the thing is, there are some small smartphones on the market. Mm-hmm. But right now, the ones that are on the market are just terrible phones. There's a few small Android phones on the market, primarily. Obviously, there's no really small iPhones. But and I don't know any nicer way to say this. They're really crappy.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't recommend them to my worst enemy. And I've known a few people that have bought some of them, and it has just been a nightmare for them.
Yeah, my mom got a bottom-of-the-barrel Android smartphone a year or so ago, and she complained that it was hard to use, so I sighed patiently and told her I'd come over and show her how to use it. Well, imagine my surprise when I tried to set up, and it had none of the standard Android features.
Right.
This was absolutely the most crippled Android smartphone ever released. I fortunately do not remember the name, or fortunately for the maker of the phone, because it was bad, and I would embarrass them right here on the podcast.
Yeah,
we got her a iPhone 4S, and she's much happier now.
Yeah, and not to pick on Android, but you know, Android is open source, which means any manufacturer can use it. And because of that, unlike Apple or even how WebOS was, where they had complete control over the software and the hardware, Google has no control over the software.
Yeah, there's a lot less
they can
quality control as far as what the company winds up doing with it.
Right, like even we've seen with Amazon how they've taken Android and built out the Fire operating system.
The Kindles run on Android, but not a recognizable version.
It's what they call a fork of the Android operating system. So with that in mind, the smallest smartphones that I think we would feel comfortable recommending are the iPhone 4S and the Samsung Galaxy S3 Mini. That's a long name, but it's the Samsung Galaxy S3 Mini. The iPhone 4S, of course, like I said before, it's got that 3.5-inch screen, so it's only about 4 inches wide. The Galaxy Mini has a 4-inch screen, so it's a little bit bigger. And honestly, neither of them sound like they're really in that range that you're looking for. At least I'm assuming from your voicemail, since you said you had an iPad, you've already looked at the iPhone and it's bigger than what you want. I mean, personally, I feel like the iPhone 4S fits comfortably in my pocket, but mm-hmm. you know, you might not agree. That's a personal preference thing. But honestly, from listening to your voicemail, I think that what you want is a feature phone or a regular phone is another way to put it.
Do they still make those?
Yeah. And I know that you said you want a smartphone, but what I believe what you really want is a phone that does maybe a few more things than what phones had in the 1990s, you know, a little bit mm-hmm. more features than they had in the 90s. Feature phones are basically what the industry calls all the other cell phones that aren't smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
They have come a long way since the 90s too, but of course, you know, smartphones have kind of stolen a lot of the thunder from them. I used to have a fantastic LG phone. It was a flip phone.
Oh yeah.
Just before I got my first Palm that had voice dialing, it was really easy to import my contacts. I could play MP3s on it. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic feature phone.
That's cool.
Now, I think it was the Music or the Fusion, something like that.
Okay.
And that's the thing. I can't even remember what it was called. But what I was saying before, there are feature phones that have all kinds of these features. And almost all of them, you can transfer your contacts into them. But there are dozens of different feature phones at every carrier. So just on the four major carrier networks here in the United States, that means there are upwards of 50 different feature phones on the market right now.
Jeez.
And they're all different, and they all have different features. And they're constantly changing the selection that they carry.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to do, and this is probably the worst advice we could give you, but it really is what you need to do, go down to your carrier and look at every single phone they have and look for the features that you specifically want. And then, unfortunately, it's still a crapshoot. I mean, you may love it or you may hate it, but I can guarantee you that you'll never be able to buy it again.
Yeah.
Because just like my LG that I loved, they don't make it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like looking for a unicorn that's pink with stripes. Unfortunately, it's just that hard.
All right. That's a vivid image, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I wish I could just give you a good answer that, you know, just pinged right what you're looking for, but not knowing what carrier you're on
mm-hmm.
and not knowing what the current selection of feature phones is, it's really impossible to say.
Yeah, yeah.
But honestly, I don't think you want a smartphone. I don't think that's what you really want.
Mm-hmm.
You want sounds a feature like phone that has these specific features, and other than that, it sounds like you don't really have any use for a smartphone.
Because mm-hmm.
you said you don't watch videos, you do email.
Yeah,
it's probably safe to assume you don't listen to music or go on the web either.
Mm-hmm.
So a smartphone might actually be a waste of money for you, because you might not need that data plan, which you're going to get stuck with if you get a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And it might just be a waste of time.
That's
so
true. Absolutely.
Yeah. I would actually go to your carrier and say, I'm looking for a feature phone that has these features. Show me what you got.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a good salesman at the store, which we can pick on them, but you know, sometimes they're few and far between, but there are some great ones out there. Hopefully they'll guide you to what you need. So mm-hmm. sorry we couldn't give you a better answer, but that is the best answer we can give on that.
Yeah, I think so.
So
we've got another question from Mallory. Ray, you want to read that?
Sure. Mallory asks, I purchased a Galaxy S3. Now, she's not talking about the Mini here. She's talking about the full-size S3 mm-hmm. about a month ago, and it gets hot. Today it cut off after the battery died and wouldn't charge, nor would it cut on for about 5 minutes. Do you know why something like this would occur, and what can I do to prevent it from happening in the future?
Mallory, thanks for the question. To me, it sounds like your phone might be overheating. Mm-hmm. Overheating is very bad for electronics because it can damage circuitry, and it's bad for you because it could cause your device to explode or catch fire.
Yeah,
that's very rare, but it actually has happened.
Yeah.
Fortunately, what they do with most modern electronics is they have built-in temperature gauges that let them know when they're getting overheated. And if the gauge detects things are getting too hot, they'll shut down the device and they won't let you turn it back on until things cool off, which sounds exactly like what happened in your case. So first of all, make sure that you aren't putting your phone in positions where it's in danger of overheating. If you have a really thick protective case that doesn't allow the phone to dissipate heat, that could do more harm than good. So if your phone starts heating up in your pocket, take it out, give it some breathing space, and definitely don't ever leave it on the dashboard of a hot car. That's just terrible for electronics.
Okay. So good phone treatment aside, what would be two reasons that might cause your phone to overheat?
Well, it's either going to be a software problem or a hardware problem. Now, hardware problems are going to include things like bad batteries, bad processors, stuff like that.
Okay.
If you have a hardware problem, unfortunately, you've got a bad phone. You need to march down to the Verizon store or the T-Mobile store and whoever you bought the phone from, and you need to get them to replace it. Sometimes you just get unlucky and get a lemon phone.
Yeah, and that can happen no matter what brand of phone you buy.
Yeah.
It happens to Apple's, it happens to Samsung's, mm-hmm. all of them can happen to.
Absolutely. But before you trade it in, let's look at the other side of things and make sure that there's not something we can fix on the software side. Now, there are times when your phone will legitimately be working a little bit harder, and in those situations, it will get warmer. If it's downloading an update, or it's using its GPS, or even if it's booting up, it's going to get a little warmer. But those situations shouldn't be happening constantly, and they should never heat the phone up so much that it shuts down. Now, fortunately, there are some ways you can see what apps are using the most battery life. From the home screen, press the menu button, and then scroll down and touch the option that says battery. You should see a screen that has a graph of your battery usage and a listing of what apps are using the battery and how much battery they're using. By percentage. It's a nice little feature on that particular phone.
Okay.
So next time your phone starts heating up, open this menu and see what apps are using a large amount of battery. It could be that you've got an app running in the background that's making your phone work over time, and that would heat up the battery and cause it to run down much faster.
That is a really convenient feature. And that's only on the Samsung Galaxy S3, or is it on other Android devices?
That's a difficult question for me to answer because, of course,
you're a Galaxy S3
user. I don't have a stock Android installation,
okay.
So I don't know if it's available on every Android.
I'm a little jealous of you. I'd love to have that kind of information on my iPhone.
But I'll get to this in a minute. There is actually also an app that you could get for any Android phone that can help you out. So next time your phone starts heating up, open this menu and see what, you know, what's using up a lot of battery. And if there's a troublesome app, you may need to uninstall it. There's also there might be some power saving options for that app. They'll be listed beside it, like turning off location services, which uses a lot of juice.
Mm.
Also, while we're in the settings menu, make sure that the power saving setting is turned to on. All you got to do is click that little power saving button to on. The free app I mentioned is something you download from the market called the Battery Monitor Widget. It will actually track the temperature of your phone battery over time.
Hmm.
That's another great way to get a handle on your phone's overheating problem. Maybe there's a dead spot where you're spending time in every day and your phone is working extra hard to find a cell phone tower. So you've got the tools to do a little detective work and find out what apps are abusing your phone's battery. But if you come up empty, your phone may just have a bad battery or some other piece of faulty hardware, and it's time to send it back to the store.
Okay. Well, yeah, I wish there was something like that for the iPhone. I'll have to look into
it. Yeah, there must be an app out there for that.
Maybe. Well, now it is time for a segment that we've been doing a little while called Debunkable. And just like you, we get emails forwarded to us all the time that have some crazy stories in them. They come from our moms, aunts, uncles, sisters, brothers, friends from work, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always one or two folks in your life that just can't help themselves when it comes to forwarding emails. Now, some of these stories, of course, are urban legends. Others are little-known facts about household products that are trying to kill you. And others, of course, are the real stories behind what happened during a famous event.
So what we do is we take those emails, we do a little research, and find out what the truth is. If you get an email forwarded to you and you want to know if it's true or fake, send it to us at debunkable@demobile.com.
All right, so this one landed in my inbox this week. It's an image slide of beautiful pictures of eagles with the following text over each picture. It reads, "The eagle has the longest lifespan of its species. It can live up to 70 years. But to reach this age, the eagle must make a hard decision in its 40s. Its long and flexible talons can no longer grab prey, which serve as food. Its long and sharp beak becomes bent.
Wow.
Its old age and heavy wings, due to their thick feathers, become stuck to its chest and make it difficult to fly.
Ouch.
Then the eagle is left with only two options, die or go through a painful process of change which lasts 150 days.
Huh?
The process requires that the eagle fly to a mountaintop and sit on its nest. There, the eagle knocks its beak against a rock until it plucks it out. After plucking it out, the eagle will wait for a new beak to grow back. Then it will pluck out its talons. When its talons grow back, the eagle starts plucking its age-old feathers.
This sounds painful.
After 5 months, the eagle takes its famous flight of rebirth and lives for 30 more years. Learn from the eagle. Spread your wings and fly." Well,
Okay.
The sentiment behind this message is true. Unfortunately, the facts behind it are not. And honestly, I saw it and I was like, oh, that's so inspirational. I'm going to forward it to everyone I know. But then I went, no, let me do a little research first. Mm-hmm. So I found out that the average lifespan of an eagle is around 30 years.
Yeah.
Not 70 years. They don't live to be 70 years old, whether it's a
even
bald eagle.
Even if they
eagle,
knock their beaks off?
Even if they knock their beaks off. It just doesn't work like that. Also, if an eagle didn't have a beak, talons, or feathers for 5 months, it would die.
Yeah.
It's just how it works. It wouldn't be able to eat.
If it's perched up on a mountaintop where it's far away from everything.
Right. So you couldn't find any prey to eat. It wouldn't know what to do. So now eagles' beaks and their talons and their feathers are made of keratin, which is the same stuff that our hair and nails are made of. What happens is an eagle's feathers actually molt or fall off at the same time or all the time, and the new ones are constantly growing back. So it's just like we lose hair and our hair grows back. We don't go bald. Well, we do
some of
old
us,
age, yeah. But, you know, it's not that, you know, we're constantly losing hair and regrowing hair. Mm-hmm. Same thing with birds. They lose feathers and they grow new feathers. And their beaks and talons actually get worn down all the time, just like our nails do or claws on an animal. Mm-hmm. They get worn down all the time and they keep growing all the time. Something that bird owners know, you know, sometimes if your bird doesn't have something to chew on, you've got to get something that it can use to grind its beak on to wear it down. So it's just like our nails and hair do. But interesting fact, did you know that eagles and a lot of birds actually molt their feathers in a symmetrical pattern?
Really?
Yeah. The reason is why is because eagles will actually, they'll lose feathers on the both sides of their body at the same time. So that they maintain balance for flight.
Oh, yeah. So they've got to remain aerodynamic.
Right. Because if they lost too many feathers on one side, they would just end up flying around in circles, which is a funny imagery. So anyway, that is another one for the trash can. It is bunk. Eagles don't go through a ridiculous, Rocky-esque, montage-worthy transformation halfway through their life at 30 to 40 years old. What usually happens when an eagle hits between 30 to 40 years is they die. Nothing inspirational happens. They don't make a choice. They're just dead. That wouldn't make for a really good email forward, would it, Tom?
No.
All right, well, we have got to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got more of your questions. You're listening to Deemable Tech.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Tom Braun, joined, of course, by my co-host, Ray Hollister.
Of course. Well, hey, we got another segment coming up here called... Oh, wait, we still haven't named this app segment. We got a couple of good suggestions, though. I think we've had Appable.
Yeah.
App-a-day. Appetite. That was mine. I can't claim that. So maybe we'll have to do an election. We'll have to...
Oh, people are tired of elections, man.
That's true. Thank goodness those are over. But yeah, maybe we can do some sort of vote on our Facebook page.
But this is the apps segment.
The apps segment where talk about the apps we like.
That's like a Microsoft name, the apps segment. Microsoft the app segment.
The Deemable Tech app segment, series 7.
That's right. Okay.
Well, Tom, what app do you have that you are really enjoying lately?
I discovered a really cool one recently called Glimpse, and it's kind of a straightforward concept. Glimpse allows somebody to, or allows you to give somebody else with a smartphone a glimpse of your current location.
Oh.
It's kind of straightforward. It shows them, you know, your real-time GPS information. But the nice thing about it is it automatically assigns a time limit to that information. So, you know, 10 minutes or something. So for 10 minutes, you know, somebody could see exactly where you are.
Interesting.
And that's really great. Say you are trying to find your way to a friend's house and you get a little lost, you know, you could send them a glimpse request or...
say, hey, where are you at?
Yeah, where are you at?
Yeah.
Or even, like, you know, if somebody's like, how long is it going to take you to get here? Just send them the glimpse and they can watch you arrive in real time.
That's true. We've played with it a little bit, actually, before one of our get-togethers where we were working on the show. And yeah, it's really accurate. Mm-hmm. I was watching you come across the bridge on your way over to where we were meeting at,
mm-hmm.
and it is really fantastic. One of the nice things about the app is that it is cross-platform.
Yes.
So it works on iOS, it works on Android, and it even works on, you don't have to have an app. Mm-hmm. You can actually send a text message with the website, and as long as you're able to access the web online on your device, you can still see it in real time right where it is.
Yeah.
So, and that was one thing, like, Apple's Friend Finder, Find My Friend, like that was a neat little feature that they brought out, but it didn't really work that well.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't updating in real time,
mm-hmm.
and it had to be somebody who had an iPhone and the same version operating system as you, and it just got too cumbersome. And also, the other person had to agree to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice that you can do it. You know, like, I can just send it to someone and say, here's where I am.
Yeah.
And you can watch me, you know, I'm on my way.
For a certain limited amount of time.
Right, for a limited amount of time. And they don't have to download an app or sign up to an agreement or do anything to actually take advantage of it. So
mm-hmm.
I do like that. It's great. It's a great feature.
Yeah.
Let's see. I've got an app, an ironic app, actually, that I just recently, I had had it for a long time,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't used it because I didn't see any use for it. And it's actually the Google search app.
Okay.
You said, you know, you mentioned to me, you sent me a text message and said, hey, download the new version. It's really awesome. And it is. They have improved the voice search on it. And I have tried comparing it with Siri. And although, you know, Siri can do some things specific, like, you know, book a table reservation or look up people in a movie. If I need to just do a search on the web,
mm-hmm.
the Google Voice or search app is fantastic for voice search.
Yeah. It's lightning fast.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
Whereas, like, I push the button, Siri talks to me, I wait for it to respond, it transcribes it, and then it figures out what I'm doing. And it takes, you know, a few seconds for it to work. I can watch it literally transcribing it right on the screen what I'm saying, and it's pulling up the search results right then.
That's fantastic.
It is really cool. So that is an app that, and it's free, of course, and Glimpse is free as well.
Yeah.
Both of those apps are free.
I think all the apps we're talking about today are...
No, I've got one that does cost a little bit, but it's worth it. We'll get to that later. But it also, another thing about the Google search app is you, in addition to voice search, you can do Google Goggles, which is their image search technology. So what you can do is you tap on the Goggles logo and hold the camera up to a logo or a painting or an image, something that is, you know, you'll be able to see on the internet somewhere, and it will search for that.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you're like, what is that painting? I recognize it. You use Google Goggles on it and it'll search it for you and tell you what it is.
Very really cool.
And like even, you know, like here in the studio, we got the WJCT logo on there. I could hold my phone up to that and it would look and find the WJCT website.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that one's a fun one. What have you got?
I've got another one. This might be helpful for a lot of people. It's kind of embarrassing for me to admit I have it. But there's an app called MedHelper. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where for some reason you have just a ton of prescriptions, medications from your doctor going at the same time, and it becomes difficult to keep track of, especially if you are going from doctor to specialist or something like that, and they're asking you, what are you taking? How many milligrams? I kind of had started looking.
I've never personally experienced that, but my dad did.
Yeah.
He was taking a lot of meds. Okay.
Yeah, so in certain situations, you need that information on you almost constantly. And if you have a lot of medications going, it can be a real pain to remember what to take when.
Right.
So MedHelper is an app I found for Android that's real nice. It's very straightforward. You can enter in the medications you're taking, the amount you're taking, and what time you're supposed to take it every day. Is it daily? Is it as needed? And it will, you know, remind you with prompts when you need to take a medication. It's handy just as a reference when you are in the doctor's office and they say, how many milligrams of so-and-so are you taking? You've got it right there. It also, what's really nice is it keeps a log. Whenever you tell it you've taken a medication, it logs that. So if you've got, you took Tylenol and you're like, oh, okay, man, I still got a headache. When was the last time I took Tylenol? Can I take it again? You could actually, if you had Tylenol in this and you'd logged when you'd taken it, you could just look in the app and be like, oh, okay, I took it 6 hours ago. I'm ready to take some more.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I do actually suffer from some, not chronic headaches, I don't think that's going so far, but frequent headaches. And I've experienced that where I'm like, okay, so what can I take now?
Right, that's exactly.
And it, a lot of times when you're just dealing with a notepad or like Google Drive, you know, keeping it stored on there, it's hard to keep track of it, you know, and share it with other people.
But this is very straightforward, very easy to use, kind of a minimalist interface. Not fancy, but it's been great.
Yeah, you told me about it a little bit before. I did a little research into it, and it is available on Android and iOS.
Excellent.
And they're actually working on making it synchronized on the cloud. So you could share it with the spouse so that they would know what you're keeping track of.
That would be nice.
And possibly even have like a web login where you could monitor it that way.
Okay.
And maybe, they don't say this here, but I could think of, you know, you could actually share it with your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have access to that information if you wanted them to have it. So that's a cool app, actually. And that one, you said, is free as well,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely free.
Okay. Let's see. Well, my app, the one that I did say that was expensive, it's not terribly expensive, but it does cost money, is an app called Text Grabber. It's one word, T-E-X-T, Grabber. And actually, it's Text Grabber and Translator. What it is it lets your phone, your iPhone specifically, turn into a mobile scanner. And it does optical character recognition.
Oh.
So, and I was looking for something to do this a while back. I was actually looking for another purpose, but I was like, there's got to be something out there that works well that I can just take a picture of something and James Bond style, it just turns into the text that it's looking at. And sure enough, Text Grabber, it's Text Grabber plus Translator. I don't know why the translator part, but it really works fantastically. I have sat and I actually just grabbed a book off the shelf and started doing it through the book, and it took me 30 seconds to do 20 pages. And it got everything right. There, it maybe had a couple of errors here and there, but considering, like, I was just surprised at how much optical character recognition has advanced in the past years.
That's cool.
And the coolest part is, it doesn't do it online. It does it on the phone.
Really?
So it's doing this optical character recognition on the phone. You don't have to have a data connection.
Well, that would be really handy internationally. You mentioned the translator thing. I'm sure what it's doing, because I've seen this, Google has a Google Translate, and what it does is you take a picture of a sign that's in a foreign language, and it will, on the bottom, and it will, you know, give it its best textual translation. So I'm sure that's what's going on there.
It does, actually, you're right. What it's doing is it will recognize 60 languages with no internet connection, including English, Korean, German, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Russian, Chinese, Korean. And it will translate it for you, but you do have to have an internet connection for that.
Oh, okay.
So, and it is, I think it's actually using Google Translate to do it. So you take a picture of a sign and it recognizes what language it's in and translates it for you. So that could be useful, but you got to be careful with your data connection when you're overseas.
Yeah, and you also got to be careful because we all know how good those translations are or aren't.
That's true. It can be kind of bad. But as far as actually just recognizing the text and turning it into a text file for you, it is fantastic.
That's excellent.
Now, as far as I know, it's only available in on iOS.
And so you mentioned a price. What's it cost?
$2.99.
$2.99.
So it's not going to break the bank. I mean, I have definitely found plenty of use for it. I'll be out somewhere and I need to write something down and I'll just grab it and take a picture of it and boom, I got the text.
There you go.
So I don't have to write it down.
Nice.
So Text Grabber, as far as I know, is only available on the iPhone or iPad. MedHelper, we mentioned before, that one is available on Android and iOS.
Mm-hmm.
Glimpse is only, or it's actually available on Android, iPhone, Windows Phone 7. I don't know about a Windows Phone 8 version of it yet, but it's also available for the BlackBerry.
Wow.
And like we said, it's also available just on the web as well. So, and the Google search app currently is only available on iPhone or on Jelly Bean. It has
yes.
those features.
It's funny because I am still on Ice Cream Sandwich and you have this ability and I don't.
Right. Ice Cream Sandwich, of course, is the old version of Android. Right. Jelly Bean is the most recent new version of Android.
Oh, Google.
Yep. So there's that segment that we talk about apps.
That segment. That app segment.
That we don't have a name for yet.
Okay. Well, let's go to that segment where we talk about emails.
All right.
We got one from Marcus, and he asks, it seems like lately, every time I get home, I have to reset my Wi-Fi router. Any idea why? I don't think we were struck by lightning or anything like that. It's a Linksys, and basically every time I come home, none of my Wi-Fi devices work. My iPhone, iPad, and Wii. I usually can just unplug the router and plug it back in, but I've had to completely reset it lately, and that's getting really old. Any advice would be appreciated. Thanks, guys. Live the show.
Wow, what a word of encouragement. Live the show. Not just do the show, but live it. Thanks, Marcus. We will live the show.
Ray, I think that was just a typo. I think he meant to say love the show.
Oh, well, okay. In that case, thanks. Anyways, okay, so back to his question. My phone's still on. Look at that. It sounds like he's having problems with his wireless router. So, Tom, do you have any advice for Marcus here?
Yeah, actually, I do. There are a number of things that could cause you to have problems with your router, but before you do any of them, I would verify that your router is actually the problem. Maybe it's not her, it's you. Know what I mean? So take your router out of the equation by plugging a computer or a laptop with an Ethernet connection, that's the one that looks like a phone cord, directly into your modem at some point when you're experiencing connection problems.
Hmm.
If your computer connects to the internet, fine and dandy, when plugged directly into the modem, then it's the router. If it doesn't, well, it's either your computer, your modem, or your internet provider that has the problem. And I'd start by calling your internet provider personally.
Okay.
But let's say you plug in and everything is fine, so we know something is going on with the router. Plug that back into the modem and let's take a look at what's under the hood. Every router has an admin page, which you can access from any internet browser. It's usually a four-part number divided by periods. The most common one is 192.168.1.1. Now, there's a reason for that number, but we're not going to get into it right now. You type that into the address bar of your browser, and that should take you to the page. If it doesn't, look up the number in your router manual.
Right, and other ones have like 192.168.0.1 or something similar. But what would happen if you threw out the router manual?
If you're on a PC, you can actually go to the start button, search, and type CMD, like command.
Mm-hmm.
Open that program, and you'll see a black box with a text prompt in it. It looks kind of scary, but I'm going to tell you what to type here. Type IPCONFIG. That's IPconfig, all one word, and hit enter. It's going to spew a bunch of technical gobbledygook at you, but you're only interested in one thing. Scroll up until you see a line that says default gateway. And there's going to be a number, the four-part separated by periods, just like we said before. And that number is your router's address, and that is the number you need to enter into the browser.
The web page that controls the router.
Yes.
Okay.
So again, enter that into your browser. This will take you to the router's control panel, but first you have to enter a password. You do know what your password is, don't you? And please tell me it's not admin, which is the default password in most routers.
And if you haven't changed it, that's probably what it is.
Now, it's unlikely that you're being hacked, but one of the first ways to make sure you aren't is to ensure that your router password is not admin. Note that this is different from the password that you use to connect to the router. This is the password to get into the actual control panel.
Right.
If it is admin, click around the control panel until you find the option to change it. Let's not make things too easy on the bad guys, right? Also, make sure that you have a really good password on your Wi-Fi connection. Make sure that you're using WPA2 security mode. Do not use WEP or WPA, only WPA2 personal or enterprise. And at least a 10-character long passphrase, but longer is better. So I like 15 to 20 characters.
Sure.
Yeah. Again, though, this is unlikely to be the cause of your problems. While you're in the control panel, check what channel your Wi-Fi is broadcasting under. On my Linksys router, I had to click on the wireless tab and then select manual settings, and then I was able to see a drop-down box called channel with the numbers 1 to 11 in it. Now, routers actually default to channel 1.
Right.
It's sort of like a TV channel almost, and it can become crowded by other signals. So try changing to a different channel, like 7 or maybe 8. Many people say that if nothing else, this actually gives their router a little speed boost, just changing the channel setting. These are some things that can work on your vanilla router without making many major changes. But if none of them work...
Well, actually, yeah, if none of them work, if none of those changes, like changing your Wi-Fi channel or, you know, changing your password in case you're being hacked or something like that, mm-hmm. then most likely the firmware that runs your router is out of date.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the firmware is like the router's operating system.
Exactly.
It's the software that makes your router work and makes the hardware do what it's supposed to do.
And it's a little verbal pun there. Get it, hardware, software, between those two.
Firmware. Right. Now, to update your router's firmware, you're going to have to check the manual that came with it. So hopefully you didn't throw it away. Or go to the router's website for instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll have to go to the config page, that the configuration page that Tom mentioned before, and that's where you'll enter your admin password. Then you'll check the firmware's version number and compare it to the latest version that's available on the company that made the router's website. So like Linksys or D-Link, whatever mm-hmm. the company is. And if there's a newer version of the firmware, download it and follow the instructions and install it. That will probably take care of your problem.
Yeah, 99% of cases.
What else could cause a problem, though?
Well, you can make sure that your router isn't overheating. They almost never have fans on them, but they can actually get pretty hot. I mean, it's kind of a little computer, basically, with all that data traffic flowing through them. So you got to make sure it has plenty of space around it to breathe. If you see that it's still getting hot, maybe consider putting a fan on it, you know, pointing a fan at it.
Yeah, that'll help. And if none of that works, then it could be that your router's firmware just isn't good, or the router has kicked the bucket, or it's just close to death.
Yeah, I've noticed routers seem to have like a 5-year lifespan, roughly.
It does seem like that, yeah. Now, if you're feeling really brave, there's a third-party firmware called DDWRT. DDWRT is really powerful, and it works on a lot of routers, but it's certainly not for everyone. I'd say it's a little more challenging than jailbreaking an iPhone or rooting an Android device. So if that's beyond your skill set, you can let your nerdy nephew or cousin try it out, or, you know, just move on and get a new router. Well, that is all the time that we have for today. Thanks for your emails, and keep them coming.
Absolutely.
It's questions@deemable.com. And call us. Leave us a voicemail at 904-372-3336. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a good review if you enjoyed it, like we always say. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't enjoy it, yeah, go ahead and leave us a good review anyway. We won't tell anybody.
That's right.
Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening, and have a great week. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange, homegrown hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting, on the web at asmallorange.com, and by A Edelson LLC, simple, green, technology consulting, on the web at aedelson.com, and by Jack's Computer Guys, providing desktop and laptop service for all of Northeast Florida, on the web at jackscomputerguys.com.